Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Piotr Kruszycki. I'm a history professor at the University of Maryland in College Park, and today I'm very, very pleased to be welcoming to our program Agnieszka Paszeka. Professor Paszeka is a social-cultural anthropologist, author of Hierarchy and Pluralism, Living Religious Difference in Catholic Poland, which came out with Paul Grave in 2015, and the forthcoming book, which will be out later this year with Princeton University Press, entitled Living Right, Far-Right Youth Activists in Contemporary Europe. She is currently a research fellow at Yale University, and this fall will be joining the Department of Anthropology as an assistant professor at the University of Montreal. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Piotr.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I'm delighted that we'll get to speak about your recently published edited volume, which came out with Rochester University Press last year, 2023, which you co-edited with Paweł Rodak, Rethinking Modern Polish Identities, Transnational Encounters. Let's begin.
Yes. Paweł unfortunately couldn't join us, but I would like to acknowledge that it was absolutely a collaborative work, well, not only ours, but also of all the authors who joined us.
Yeah, I want to hear much more about the different chapters. This is, I think, the exciting thing about talking about a collaborative work is, of course, you can speak to the book, but you can also speak to your own individual points. And I actually wanted to start maybe with this specifically. The word encounters, which you put at the very center of the title of the book, of course, it's also an encounter in and of itself, the book. And that's a point that you make in the introduction. It's a point that comes up in the afterword. And I wanted to ask how you originally approached the idea of putting together a book that would involve scholars from both sides of the Atlantic, and also that would reach an audience and encounter different audiences. Did you have a strategy in mind? Was this all an accident? What shaped this particular encounter?
Thank you so much, because this is truly a beautiful question. And I think I can start by saying that we did take very seriously this idea of encounter. So it was both, like, it was literally an encounter of different people, but also metaphorically an encounter when we think about different disciplinary traditions meeting, different languages, different ways of writing. So these different encounters, I think we can say, truly shaped this project from the outset, because the origins of the book actually originated, the idea of the book originated after a conference that we held in Warsaw in 2015, where numerous scholars from both sides of the Atlantic presented their work. And what was beautiful was the fact that the conference was bilingual, that some people who felt more comfortably presenting their work in Polish spoke in Polish, those who preferred to speak in English spoke in English. But there was dialogue all the time, and we were, you know, sometimes helping people translate certain terms. We were reflecting together on how to best render certain term in English or Polish. And that's when we began, Paweł and I, thinking how to actually render this multiplicity, this beautiful dialogue, how to transform it into a book. And we had then we decided to publish a volume where the different contributions from the conference could be published. There were many more people at the conference. I should add, unfortunately, not all of them were able to join us. But when I say that we took this idea of encounter seriously, is that when we think about an encounter, we think about something democratic. At least that's my idea of the encounter. So we didn't want to impose certain style. We didn't want the English language. I mean, the book is published in English, but we didn't want to have this hegemony of English so obvious. So Polish writing style, as you well know, is much more essayistic, right? And there was a bit of a challenge of negotiating with the reviewers of the book, saying, no, we want to actually allow authors to speak their voice, because how to speak about plurality of Polishness, how to speak about plurality of Polishness if we silence some voices, some writing traditions? So that's what I mean by having openness to what we learned from this encounter, what authors learned from each other. We were encouraging authors to read each other contributions, to cross citations, cross citations throughout the book, but also really to let this disciplinary backgrounds as well as the trainings, the ways of writing, speak in the book, and I hope that's visible.
It clearly is. For my part, I think that the chapters fit together really well. And I want to talk a little bit more later on about audiences again. But since you've already referenced the contents of the book, let me ask, and this is an entirely unfair question, I think, if you could explain in a few sentences for someone who has not seen the book at all yet, what the main topic, idea, what is it that holds the book together? Because modern Polish identities is a pretty capacious phrase. So for you, what is the real thread that runs through?
Wow, that's a very important but at the same time tricky question, because it means perhaps highlighting some aspects, and I don't want to. I will try to pay justice to all the contributions in the volume, and I'm aware that the moment we hear Polish identity, many people say, "Oh my God, again, yet another book about Polish identity." And our aim was very different. Our aim was precisely not to have yet another book of on Polish identity, but in a way to have a to twist twist a bit this classical questions on Polish identity. So I think there is a in the introduction I speak about this a classical Polish narrative where the martyrdom plays so much part, and the national uprising, and the heroism during different wars. So we want to talk about anti-heroes, about non-religious people, about non-Catholics, about philo-Semites, right? To think about this kind of there are certain tropes, cultural tropes that are often attached to the idea of Polish identity, and we wanted to ask, what about this anti-trope, so to say, to how to tackle these questions from a different perspective. That's why Genevieve Zubrycki talks about philo-Semites in her chapter, and how Jewishness, how Polishness is, as she put it, redefined through Jewishness, through the interest in Polish culture, in Jewish culture. Brian Porter Schutz talks about has a fascinating account of how this idea of Polish Catholic comes into being, and shows it to be not as hegemonic as we would like it often to see. Shows actually that it that what is taken for granted very often in the literature is far from true. Kelly Stauter-Harstedt, who talks about this transatlantic construction of Polish identity, how much migrations, overseas migrations, shaped Polish culture, Polish cultures back in Poland, how the migrants coming back from the US were influencing when influencing the developments in Poland, and thinking about Polish identities in Poland. There are many chapters, such as, for example, Ilona Grudzińska-Gross chapters, which problematic which shows how unwillingly the Polish identity was often granted to the people, how much struggle people had to how much struggles identifying oneself as Polishness that meant for many people, that they weren't recognized necessarily as Polish, and often in the environments that we would normally consider tolerant and progressive, perhaps. So she there is I could probably say in brief that we really tried to problematize this mainstream narrative, and that also shows that many phenomena that we consider as new, because, for example, we have a chapter on representation of Polish people, Polish migrants in the cinema. This is a chapter by Chris van Kukelem, and but we also showed how this how we shouldn't think about migration as a new phenomenon. We show much like longer roots of the phenomena that are very often mistakenly considered considered to be recent. Yeah.
Just the multiplicity of different threads that you raised in your answer, I think, really speaks to the richness of the book. And I'm going to follow up on a couple things. Let's say maybe in the order that they struck me. The first point that you raised was concerning not. I mean, it's based in University of Michigan sociologist Genevieve Zubritsky's chapter, but also speaks to a book she published recently. I actually highlighted it on this podcast not long ago. Also to Irena Grudzińska-Gross's chapter in your book. And I wanted to talk for a minute about what Polishness and Jewishness mean in the context of one another. The first question I would ask you, though, is what you think the right time frame is for that conversation. Is it a, for Genevieve, obviously it's stretched over time. It's a 21st century conversation. It's a 20th century conversation. If we talk about the origins of modern anti-Semitism in Poland and we follow, go back to Brian Porter Such's work, it's very much a late 19th century conversation. Do you think it makes sense to keep the timeline as long as possible, or zoom in on, let's say, the Holocaust or its aftermath? Obviously, this engages a lot of different questions. The question of wartime killings and pogroms of Jews by their neighbors, going back to the 19th century, potentially. I'm just curious, where's the right place to start, and does it make sense to try to keep it more contained or to keep it as broad as possible?
I think it very much depends on the context, because, and I think we could bring here yet another chapter from the book, which is a chapter by Paweł Bukowiec, who describes the case of a bishop living in Lithuania who was sometimes identified as Polish, sometimes as Lithuanian, sometimes as Belarusian. And Paweł also asked a very important question, actually, who decides, right? Who is that's also the question we ask in the book, that Irena Grudzińska-Gross and Genevieve and many other people, who decides, right? So also this tension between self-identification, right, and ascription of identity by others. And I think in Polish history, as probably is in many other national histories, we have plenty of examples of people. You know, for me, such a exemplary figure is Polish poet Julian Tuwim, who was stubbornly repeating, "I'm a Polish Jew. My Polishness is so strongly like intertwined with my Jewishness, and both these identities, which is actually one identity, right, are reflected in my writings." And then he was rejected by the Polish right, that was saying, "No, we are not writing in Polish, we're writing about it like a Jew," and by Jewish people who were saying, "You are betraying Jewishness by assimilating into Polish culture." And I think these are the kind of figures that we describe in the book. But Tuwim, who his most important works were published in the 1930s. So we could, and of course, what follows are the tragic events of the World War II and Holocaust and so on. But I think Paweł's work on where he discusses the context of 19th century, this 19th century national awakenings, Lithuania, Poland, Belarus, shows that it could be also a question in the even if we think about these modern nations, let's say, coming into being in the 19th century. I think depending on the context, this discussion could be like very meaningful also when we think about earlier historical periods. I think it really very much depends.
Thank you very much. I'm struck also by your answer here. recalling a point that you made in the introduction about the dangers of nostalgia. And I actually remember the point that you and Paweł made about the multiculturalism of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. This idea that if we look back far enough, there was some element of harmony, it maybe is kind of a facile way of putting it, but a balancing act or an integration of some sort or a coexistence, which completely fell apart as we fell in, as we got deeper and deeper into the modern period. And I very much appreciate the point of the dangers of that kind of nostalgia and how it deforms the potential perspective from the 21st century. I'm curious, I mean, you've brought up several different examples, but now that you've sort of brought these different chapters together, do you feel like, I mean, to quote also from your introduction, the exclusionary undertones of supposedly egalitarian strands? In other words, even when we have a discourse that makes it seem like everyone's included, everyone's equal, there's an underbelly to that discourse. Is that one of the messages you think here?
This is definitely one of the messages. I'm not sure, however, if I would put it as a danger of nostalgia, rather than perhaps as a danger of this kind of presentist readings, or like using present day categories to describe developments in the past. Sometimes out of nostalgia, and sometimes because like the authorities of a village in rural Poland think that that's a great marketing strategy to recall past multiculturalism of the area and saying, by the way, there was a Jewish state and there was a Ukrainian minority and they all lived together happily. And that was actually our local multiculturalism, which we know is just these are not the categories that makes much sense when we think about the past. Because one of the persons actually whose work is referenced in our book, a historian of the University of Warsaw, Urszula Augustyniak, who is a reference, as far as I remember, in Liza Jakielski, a chapter on Witold Lutosławski and Lithuanian and Polish classical music, yet another beautiful chapter. She quotes Augustyniak comment who and her very important observation that how can we even, it's not only about using the category of multiculturalism, that it's not only that the use of that category is wrong, the very notion of culture was so different. Augustyniak observes at the time, in those periods that were supposedly multicultural, we were talking, people very often considered there was Christian and non-Christian culture. This was the understanding of culture. Or perhaps we could think about the peasant and nobility culture, but talking about Ukrainian, Polish, Belarusian culture is just nonsensical. And that's, I think, a very, very important observation. Also, like what multiculturalism could have meant the moment that a vast majority of the population weren't even considered equal, weren't even considered citizens, right? In a place where like the serfdom was the norm, and the nation was the only members of the nation were representatives of the nobility. So this shows very clearly that it's not only about the dangers of the nostalgia, but just dangers of wrong historical reading, or like dangers of the analysis. But I think your questions point to something else much more important, to how even this most progressive, supposedly tolerant promoting, egalitarian promoting discourses have this underlining like exclusionary mechanisms, sometimes implicit, sometimes explicit. And I think that's what we are that's I think what Irena Grudzińska-Gross shows wonderfully in her chapter, because she quotes, for example, like letter exchanges among the writers who are, part of the Polish literature pantheon, and that they would never expect of like anti-Semitism or like intolerance attitude, and they are making comments such as, "Oh, he was a Jew. I would never expect, but he is a good man, right?" And that's a writer that every Polish child reads at school, and like, and the so this kind of comment also that were probably considered even a norm at the time, right? I'm using node in the as in inverted commas because that shows very clearly also
I was going to say,
this
make sure you're using, you say that you're using inverted
yes,
commas.
yes, yes. The no, yeah, of course. So I think yeah, that's definitely one of the important messages. Looking also, that's why that's what I was emphasizing, that we are looking for this like an obvious aspects of the discourse on Polishness, right? So that is not only that anti-Semites are the one who excludes, how even some exclusionary tones can be hidden in like this philosemitic discourses, for example.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I mean, I really appreciate how you bring the different chapters together with your thinking on this. And I'll ask you one more question on this point, because I think some of the claims that Grudzińska, Grosin, Zubrzycki make are so powerful and so striking in terms of how they don't go to presentism. They precisely show the presence of the past. So there's this richness of description of each a moment that they're dissecting, which I thought really tied in and illustrated well the broader points you're making. But this idea that, I'm quoting from page 99, that public discussion about Jews in Poland is actually about the very identity of Poland, or from very similar spot in the book, that precisely because Jewishness carries specific significations and symbolic capital that other minorities in Poland do not possess, it is primarily through Jews and Jewishness that a modern multicultural Poland is articulated. It is such a striking claim, given as you pointed out here, right, the focus in the historiography on anti-Semitism, and rightly so. And the question there becomes also, I mean, you've alluded to this already, what does philo-Semitism mean? It can mean a range of things, and the experience of it and the lived reality of it also. So I'm just curious if you can sort of reflect a little bit on what the modern multicultural Poland looks like, having finished a book where that is a really striking claim. Mm-hmm. Does it mean, for example, that Poles should look more toward the Jewish past, that they should try to dialogue in a different way with Jewish communities at home and abroad, or that really it's become almost a self-serving trope to focus on Jewish history in Poland? I'm curious, maybe I'm putting this in a little bit too extreme of a frame, but I'm very curious what you think.
Fantastic question, which I think also opens like a lot of comparative perspective, because while the book is about Polishness, we were very much hoping that it would foster general reflection on national identities at large, so to say. And I think that in a way, we could say perhaps a bit cynically that multiculturalism in Poland nowadays is what multiculturalism is in many other places in Europe and perhaps beyond. And I would say that it usually serves the group, the dominant group, because multiculturalism is often this mechanism that actually helps the dominant group to feel good about themselves. We are so tolerant. We accept migrants. We are inclusive. We invest, 2% of funds for education in like language classes for minorities. And we have this festival in our village, and we have this, day where all the kids cook, foods from their countries. And it's so multicultural. So it doesn't matter whether it's Poland or the Netherlands or the right. So this idea, which, really self this kind of, is a kind of like, I think if we recall another Polish writer, Henryk Sienkiewicz, who wrote trilogy at the time of partition, and there was the expression, you help me here, Piotr, what is it, to like cheer up, ku pokrzepieniu serc, to cheer up the hearts?
To warm the cockles of the heart.
Yeah, exactly. So this is also multicultures today is equivalent of that. Warm the hearts. We are so great and so tolerant and so open-minded. So I don't think in that regard Poland differ much from other countries where multicultural is, whether as idea or as policy, I think simply doesn't work. And I don't want to be as cynical about it. I just think that it doesn't work because ultimately promotes this idea of like separate cultural entities rather than thinking, you know, about like multiple like levels of connections between the people and, you know, why not come out class background or why not come out hobbies, right? Like this idea of this like ethnic culture language, which is of course something that should be supported, but I don't think it necessarily makes contemporary societies much more tolerant, much more open-minded, prevents prejudices, and so on. But so you ask me what this Polish multicultural today should be, whether it means looking back more into Jewish past or like pluralizing school curricula, I think that's for sure, but should be also probably more open to Ukrainian migrants coming into Poland and to Syrian migrants who would like to come to Poland and to Afghan people who are standing somewhere in the forest at the Belarusian borders in the cold, right? So this probably what a meaningful multiculturalist could actually mean, which would be beyond this kind of, you know, ethnic festival at school once a year. But to me, like real multicultural policy would be just like, you know, should be like synonymous of like, you know, common humanity. That for me, what policy would be, but I don't know in whose interest it is actually to promote something like that, and to what extent, you know, how much of a utopia is that?
Well, I think this question maybe is a good moment to pivot to Europe, which of course is the focus of one of the chapters, Poles and Europeanness. But you and Pavel bring this point up in the introduction that we've now hit, oh, really, you know, over 20 years of Poland in the EU. And what does that mean? Or more generally, former Soviet-dominated space belonging to the European Union, and not just because of the European Union's central, you know, role in the imaginary of Ukrainian politics and the role it might play in the war in Ukraine, but do you feel that Europe and the European horizon line somehow speaks to the questions that you were just raising about a multicultural future? Or I get the sense from the way you ended your answer that you might be similarly inclined to be cynical about Europe on the whole. Just guessing here.
Well, I think well, I did emphasize that I'm trying not to be cynical. Perhaps what you call cynical for me is being realistic. And although I do like I very much like, and I think we should recover a lot of utopian thinking. What I perhaps, and here I also come a bit from my research on the far right, and for which, and as we know, for different kinds of far right constituencies in Europe, discourse of migration and on diversity is the central one. And well, it will be hard to probably find more xenophobic, more racist, more exclusionary discourses than those far right. And what I find extremely dangerous, problematic, that some of the statements of European Union leaders and of the leaders from Olaf Scholz to Emmanuel Macron to like Polish and Hungarian right-wing populist leaders, they're very often a less extreme version of those that I found on the far right. It's about the protection of the identity, European identity, protection of the borders, which is very often it's about this, right? When scholars of the far right emphasize increasingly that we cannot only talk about the far right polluting the mainstream, but that this relation goes both ways, right? That the far right also takes a lot, see what's going on in the center, and just put it to more extreme. So that is sort of like mutual relation between this like center that is far from open and tolerant, and the far right. So, but answering your question more concretely, I think in a country like Poland, there is this continuous fascination with Europe as this kind of, you know, promised destination, sort of promised destination for for many individuals, right, for whom it was the idea of mobility, or like perhaps making career, finding jobs in Europe was a dream, but also destination for Poland, like becoming this full-fledged European country. But I think at the same time, experiences of many migrants and also experience with like often this, let's say, far from ideal policies of the EU, I think bring about now they produce this more complex image of Europe. So what I would say that what coexists today, and I think the chapter by Marisa Galbraith about these ideas of Europe in Poland is still, even though she carried out her research by now, I think it will be a decade ago, I think it's quite up to date. The image of Europe in Poland that she portrays there, probably, however, I would say that it gains, we could perhaps say it gains even more color. It's increasingly complex image of Europe. It is no longer this like clear ideal, this kind of like goal that we're aspiring to, but because of like of often like bitter experience of migration and well also perhaps people who are prone to this kind of like right-wing discourses of the supposed gender dangers coming from Europe. I think this discourse on Europe is more complex today than it used to be.
So I do want to talk about your new book before we finish, but I have other things I want to discuss first about the book you and Paweł Rodak did together, if that's okay. And some of it has to do, because obviously you edited the book, so you wrote the introduction, you framed it. A lot of the what you and Paweł Rodak brought that the reader will see has to do with framing and organizing and facilitating the encounters, right? But since you also contributed a chapter, I wanted to ask you a few things about that as well. I think it's fascinating considering Polishness through the lens of Massachusetts, and particularly rural Massachusetts. It's not something that I've thought about before, although it leads me to questions that I have considered before. And some of them, you've touched on these topics already a number of times in our conversation. Migration, I don't think we've used the word diaspora, but certainly it's central here. And I mean, there's maybe a broader framing that we can take here, which is, and this is something I think speaks far beyond the Polish story, how do we think about the relationship between nation and national identity on the one hand and diaspora on the other? And I know that that's only one of the questions you engaged in your chapter, but I'd love to hear more about, and I'm sure our listeners would love to hear also about your experience with the Polish American community in rural Massachusetts.
Thank you. Yet another great question, which actually made me realize that perhaps I do not talk when answering questions enough about this Polish identity in plural, because we are talking about is actually Polish identities. And diasporas tend to be this context in which yet another national identity is being produced. Right. So sometimes this construction of identity within the diaspora may affect the construction of identity back home. And I mentioned the chapter by Keeley about this so-called circular migration and migrants going to the US, coming back to Poland, bringing some technological inventions and affecting culture back home, buying some present for the local parish that was completely affecting the life of community and so on and so forth. But so sometimes there will be like very strong ties between this diasporic constructions of, in this case, Polishness and constructions of Polishness back home, and they will mutually influence each other. But in the case of the community that I studied, of the Polish farmers, Polish American farmers in Massachusetts, it was interesting to me that since most of the people that I studied did not actually keep ties in Poland, they preserved this idea of Polishness recounted, retold them by grandparents and parents. And it was a sort of like nearly their own idea of Polish identity that they were then contrasting in the interviews that I carried out with them with my understanding of what Polish identity is. And they would tell me things like, we heard that there are no trees in Poland. Is that true? And I was trying to like dig out like, how is it possible that someone told them that there are no trees in Poland? And it turned out that the grandparents were trying to convince them that it was worth trying to make it in the US despite all the hardship and the difficulty of working at the farms and the discrimination they were experiencing, first from so-called Yankees and then from Irish and French Canadians. And so to convince them to stay, they were like overemphasizing the poor conditions in Poland to make it even more convincing, the idea of like making it in the new in the new homeland. So this Polish identity in Massachusetts is made of this stories of hardship in Poland, but also of some specific Polish expressions, such as babcia, dziadu, sometimes sort of like some neologism such as wilia, which is a short account for Vigilia, Christmas Eve, some Polish or Polish-like dishes. This is their Polish identity that they consider to be something like quasi-sacred, I would say. And they preserve it and transmit from generation, but it has no contact, hardly any contact with the Polish, with what Polish identity is in Poland at the moment. Although, of course, we should emphasize that there are multiple constructions of Polishness in Poland too. And what's even more striking, that many of these people traveled throughout the world, but they never made it to Poland. And I think one of my interpretations here is that there is a bit of fear of this encounter with the Polish identities in the old homeland.
But the resulting question seems to be who gets to decide and authorize the usage of the word, right? So it's again we're using air quotes here. It's their Polishness and their version of what it means to be a Pole, which I mean you just illustrated perfectly with that point about reluctance actually to go to Poland. I mean, it's not true in all cases, I'm sure, but it's striking the point you just made about the fact that you can track the international travels of some of these subjects. Your chapter really made me think, not just your chapter, Kielestadt or Halstead's chapter as well, and several of the others about the relationship between the local, the national, and the global. And this is almost a commonplace. Sometimes it's even boring to bring this up now, right? Sure, different geographies, multiple geographies, whatever. But I do think it's worth reflection, of course. And you gave a great example why, because just the choices for particular localities, how they move from what's in their heads or what's in their traditions to actual places on the globe, that is determinative and that shows something. So I'm curious whether you want to talk about your own chapter or you want to talk more generally about the book. I'll pose the same question. Modern in your introduction seems somewhat connected to global or foreign. How modern or not are the different versions of Polishness that you feel are projected or analyzed in the book? I say this also because modern is one of the words in your book's title, right? How modern are they, and does that exclude the kind of zoomed in focus, or is it, harder to answer that question when you do that kind of zoomed in focus on the local?
Thank you very much. Very, very rich question. And would you allow me to come back to the question that you asked before about like who decides, who comes forward?
Of
May
course, yes.
I ask something for that? Because that allows me to talk a bit about the chapters, a bit more about some chapters in the book. But I will return to this question of how modern. Because one of the contributions that I mentioned by Paweł Bukowiec, actually I invited Paweł to the conference thanks to the beautiful article that I read by him in which he quotes a conversation between two Jewish people, two Polish Jews, I should add. And they are talking about, and one is, and they are asking at a certain point, who is the most important Polish writer? And they are listing like four Polish both Jewish names that like most readers of Pavel's article never heard about, which shows like these were the people considered by them the representative of the Polish literature. And most people nowadays, unfortunately, don't know about it. But for that Polish Jew who was asked that question, these were the representative. So this I think speaks also to the example of Julian Tuwim that I gave. And I think this shows so beautifully also this tension between inclusion and exclusion, right? Because through the examples that person quoted by Paul gave, he's saying, yes, we need to count these people as a representatives of Polish literature, while too many people are not to only anti-Semites and far right. So it will be, this is not unthinkable. Henryk Sienkiewicz is the most important Polish writer. What are they talking about? Who knows them, right? So there's a question of canon entering to the picture, and there is this question of like, right, like the power to decide, but also like how inclusive, exclusive we are ourselves in our judgment. Because perhaps even you reading that story would think, but who are these people, right? So this question, who decides, remains fundamental. And to me, that example that Pavel brought is also like, for me, a bit of, I always think about it as sort of like lesson of humility, right? Of like being more open to like what's out there. And I remember my very first trip to the United States when I got to the airport in New York and I couldn't find my way, and I asked a person about like whatever the bus stop, and the person immediately heard the woman that I asked immediately heard my accent and asked, where you come from? I said, from Poland. And she said, I'm Polish too. And then she told me, you know, that like 5 generations ago, and I thought, that person consider herself doing Polish. That was for me, that I always use that as this another example of this like a lesson of humility. And this leads me to this question of like how modern it is. Because I so in other words, it's not about chronology, because you can have like a, but it's about which voices we allow to speak, which voices we allow to be a part of this narrative. Because it's not about whether it's 19th century and 20th century where we think about modernity as a historical period, but whether we would allow the voice of a Polish Jew quoted by Paweł Bukowiec to be a part of this conversation and says, yes, that's yet another version of a Polish identity, that's yet another text of Polish identity, or even more, that's yet another way of being Polish, right? Because we don't talk in the book only about the constructions of the identity or like this narrativized versions of identity, but we also talk about, in the last part of the book, we talk what we call about identity performances. In Ryszard Koziołek chapter about the famous exhibition, Pole's own portraits, or Małgorzata Litwinowicz chapter on Polish landscape, this and national exhibitions, how this idea of like the kind of materialized idea of Polish culture was being represented. So it's about performing, narrating, right? And which of those are hegemonic, which are counter-hegemonic? What with time become hegemonic, perhaps.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground when it comes to the book that brings us here today. I feel like we could keep talking about lots of the different chapters. I did want, as promised, to talk about your not even most recent work, but the book, the monograph that's coming out any minute now. So you've referenced already the far right, and I feel like this book clearly establishes you as one of the global authorities on the European right now. So, in that new role, or maybe not so new role for you, let me ask you, what does fascism look like in Europe today? What do you think?
So, as with Polish identity, that we need to discuss in plural because I'm in Polish identity. So, the argument that I make in the book is that we have to think about fascism in plural. There are varieties of fascism, and there are some versions of fascism appeal to some groups of population, some ideas of fascists appeal to other people. And first of all, this what we think of is interwar fascism appears to be quite a sort of like truly rich repertoire of ideas and practice that these people can draw on nowadays. So they can pick some of these ideas, some of these practices, abandoning others. So I think the best illustration of that is the economic agenda of parties and movements that we tend to name today fascists and neo-fascists. And there are people nowadays, there are scholars who write about the rise of neoliberal fascism and see in this like extreme from free market ideology the biggest threat of present day fascism. And they are people like more similar to the groups that I studied, who are for whom the one of the biggest contributions of the interwar fascists was the fact that it was trying to marry nationalism with socialism. They will always remind that Mussolini was a socialist and that was his background, and they will think about national autarky and this comparative model. So this shows already these two quite extreme ideas of like how to organize economy show very well that we really have to think about these different renderings of fashion and different attempts to adapt it to present day circumstances. But also means that because I also argue in the book that this inspirations from fascists, this present day fascism is not only what present day is really very future oriented agenda for many of these groups. So it's like, so how we organize economy, how we organize economy in the context of climate change. These are the questions that these groups are asking, for example, and like, what do we do in the context of scarce resources, right? So these are, and there this context of interwar fascism, which by the way, we also have to think about interwar fascism because the Romanian Iron Guard, after all, differed quite significantly from De Rivera's models in Spain and Mussolini's model in Italy, right? So like, what do they draw on and how they adapted to present-day circumstances may have very, very different, may result in quite different understanding of fascism and attempt to like translate it into politics.
I'm thinking, for example, to come back for a moment to an earlier topic when we discussed the book you and Pavel put together, that anti-Semitism is clearly central in some of the movements you've studied and marginal in other movements. Is that fair? Or is anti-Semitism one of really the organizing tropes as you think about what's borrowed or still alive continuously from the 1930s?
Yes, very important question. And especially, I think, at the moment in the context of the war in Gaza, because that's, for example, like a very important question, what mobilizes the support from Palestine on the right? Numerous far-right groups are very vocal in their support for Palestinian cause. And the question is it sympathy with the oppressed, or is it the long-standing anti-Zionist rhetoric that now just has yet another there's a new yet another context in which that can be expressed and made more pronounced. So I remember there were a lot of articles appearing, especially written by anthropologists studying migration, but also like different far-right constituencies who were suggesting that Islamophobia is nowadays a sub nowadays in a way is more important than and is that anti-Semitic rhetorics is vanishing a bit and Islamophobia is more pronounced. I would say that they perfectly coexist. Sometimes Islamophobia even uses the old anti-Semitic tropes, and this anti-Semitic and Islamophobic tropes can be simply activated depending on the context. However, again, this question is ultimately quite difficult when we think about the variety of far-right actors, because when we think about politicians of the some far-right parties in the West, for example, in the Western Europe, in the Netherlands, for example, when this idea of defense of Judeo-Christianity and the defense of LGBTQ against Muslims becomes a new card, actually nearly a leitmotif in the discourse of the right, while other movements who are like more traditional, traditional in inverted commas, I guess, would be like really far from embracing this kind of discourse. They're very conservative when it comes to the narrative of on gender roles, on understanding of like gender and sex, and also continuously, I would say, both anti-Semitic and Islamophobic.
Clearly, we could go with this topic in terms of the various strands of what goes into the far right, but I actually want to ask you a question about method, and it's a question that also goes back in some ways to the various contributions in rethinking modern Polish identities, which is, how do you, as a scholar, think about drawing on material in your own writing that, to put it bluntly, makes a lot of your subjects look not so great, right? Or I'm not, without getting necessarily into politics, maybe they're perfectly happy to be represented. Maybe anonymizing takes care of a lot of it. But on the other hand, part of the point is to say that there is a normative valence here, right? There is a kind of a trajectory. There are lessons we're learning. I'm just asking, you know, without going necessarily into specific examples, how do you think about it broadly?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's an extremely important question. And you might be surprised to hear that one of the problems that I encountered in presenting my research material on the far right wasn't actually the fact that I used the material that makes them look not too good. Quite the contrary, I was often accused by my audience of humanizing fascists, as they would put it, and like as making them look too nice and too human and too normal. And what I emphasize in my studies is that, to me, one of the most difficult aspects of the research on the far right, the research that was extremely difficult for me for numerous reasons at the intellectual, emotional, psychological level, was how normal, again, normal in inverted commas, the people that I studied are, that they are true, that I met them at the violent demonstrations, but I also was invited for dinner to their home and realized that they have like perfectly normal family life. And actually they are like devoted kindergarten teachers, and they don't necessarily spread in the kindergarten fascist agenda. They like try to like keep the spheres of life separate. So this normality, which also of course provokes important question, what pushes people to engage in this extreme milieu? Why is it that they, as they put it, find the safe haven in the far right? At the same time, I am aware that my book, once it's out, won't necessarily make happy many of my research participants, but I think this is now not our job as researchers to make people happy. Our job is to try to give tools to understand the social reality, which is complex and messy. And the picture that we are drawing is never perfect, or for sure not complete. But I think it's also about realizing that we have many, many different, sometimes competing responsibilities towards the audience, towards the research participants, towards the knowledge production, towards ourselves also, right? And I think I tried to always, when I was doing research, but also then when writing, have in mind all these issues. Probably when writing about, probably many of these problems actually apply to the chapter about Polish farmer in Massachusetts, because I took very seriously their claims, their stories, their identities. But
I admit that I was thinking about the anti-Semitism in their statements also when I was formulating that question.
And sometimes that's also the nature of ethnographic research that I do, that this ethnographic encounters tend to be very informal. So there's also this border between what's interview, what follows after, sometimes is quite blurred, right? And what sounds as an innocent joke in the interview may not sound that innocent when one is on paper, right? But at the same time, and while for me, it's not only a corpus of my data, but it's something that really helps me to make sense of the situation that I was describing.
I really think that the last answer in some ways perfectly encapsulates a lot of the core threads of the whole conversation we've had, wide ranging as it is. Maybe, and I know that Living Right is just about to come out, but do Do you have a new project that you want to introduce or float a little bit for the audience?
Yes, I actually decided to continue working on the far right, not because it's not disappearing from the social political landscape, but I think it does help us to understand lots of things that are going on, and not only on the far right. And the project that I'm beginning at the moment tackles far right environmental politics, how the far right thinks about environmental issues, not only what they think about climate change, whether they deny it or not, because they don't deny it actually, but actually how they link it with other points of their agenda, with their ideas about family, with their ideas about race, but also how they actually try to rethink socio-economic system through their policies on environment. And I link it also with the question, which allows me to go back to the question of rethinking Polish national identity, because I also show how actually this very adjective nationalistic or nationalist may be losing importance in the years to come. Because what I observe on the in the in the far right groups that I'm studying is a increasingly pronounced turn towards the region, towards the locality, and it as a different way of identity construction, but thinking about the place, about the roots, and that also linked with the question of environment, sustainability, building, self-sufficient communities, but always a linking with identity question, however, not necessarily in the nationalist terms.
Sounds fascinating. And also rather counter to a lot of conventional wisdom, which is always exciting in terms of the conversations you're going to have, I'm sure.
That's actually as that's probably the leitmotif of our conversation, the counter story, which sometimes turns out to be like a very, very important story.
Exactly. On that note, please, everyone in the audience, I hope you'll appreciate and virtually join me in thanking Professor Agnieszka Paszeka for being my guest today. It was such a pleasure to discuss the book that you co-edited with Paweł Rodak, Rethinking Modern Polish Identities, Transnational Encounters, which came out in 2023 with University of Rochester Press. And then, of course, much more as
Well, thank you for this encounter, I could say, because ours was
well.
also really encountered in many, many ways.
Touche. It was a pleasure. And thanks as always to our listeners. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you so much.